Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Guy.
Hi, Gary. Right, so good one this week. It's Patrick Leonard, who's my dear old pal, in fact, who is actually out of the three longest working relationships I have. He's number two.
Wow. Wow. I must be number one, surely.
Our relationship stopped working a long time ago, darling.
but to explain to people who this man is, because he's our second producer. He's a guy behind the scenes. He's a major writer. He was really the guy who created the Madonna, the mature Donna.
The mature, yeah. He did the kind of grown up. He started with True Blue, but then, yeah, Like a Prayer was the album where Madonna grew up. But he'd done so much before that. I mean, he's a really renowned keyboard player. I mean, you know, with the Jacks, he toured with the Jacksons, toured with Madonna, Frank Zappa. That I want to talk to him about. I've never really talked to him about that.
But he's produced Roger Waters and Elton John, Leonard Cohen in his later years, Ferry, Stewart. I mean, the list is endless, right, of who he's worked with.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hello. Hi, Gary.
Hey, Pat. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Guy is fuffing around in the background. He's putting something against his window because he's got too much brightness coming in.
Yeah. No, I've been darkening this one down all morning.
I can't see you yet. Your video isn't on.
Isn't? It's not.
There's a screen down on the left-hand side.
Ah, there it is. Do you see me now?
Wonderful. Oh, my
there
God.
I
you look... Hello. You're in NASA control room.
Well, it is actually my workspace, and it's the only place there's a computer that works.
That
so here we are.
Is beautiful stuff in the background.
Hey, yeah. Pat.
Hi, Pratt.
All right, let the record show, by the way, you are the only person on Earth allowed to call me that. I don't want
really?
Anyone who knows me listening to get any ideas. A couple of people can get away with Pratty, but only you have that, Pat.
Okay, well, that's good. privileged already.
is that a VC, whatever it is at the back flashing there? That sort of 70s synth, is it? What is that?
No, it's all modular. It's just all some older modules, some newer modules, but it's just all modular stuff. It's kind of became a kind of bad addiction.
I can contest to that. Yeah. Last time I came over, Pat, it was like you were very much down the rabbit hole. Of modular synthesis.
No, yeah, but I got better at it, so it's more fun now.
Do you prefer stuff out of the box then, Pat, rather than in the computer? You prefer?
Yeah, I don't. I stopped doing that, Gary. I some time ago, about 2016 or something, I had my big screen and all my VSTs and all my stuff, and everything was in Logic and whatever I was doing, and it just one day I went, this doesn't sound like music to me. So I got rid of all of it and started just building up regular synths. I don't have a VST and I don't use...
Wow.
Yeah, I just use a VST for our civilian listeners?
A plug-in, a keyboard plug-in, you know, so...
They're basically apps for the things that we used to have valves in the old days.
That's right. That's right. So the Mini Moog that's here, you can get a Mini Moog plug-in. But the Mini Moog sounds different. I'll just say different, so no one goes, what do you mean?
I think a lot of it, because I think a lot of the stuff that used to appeal to you about it was because everything that you get from digital and from plugins and everything is also ordered and what have you and already done. The fact that when you make a modular sound, it's only there in that second. You can never recreate it.
No, there's no such thing as a preset of any kind.
And do you think music today, I mean, we're old guys, right? So we're going to be a bit bitchy about the new guys. But do you think music today generally has a similar sound to it because we're all using the same plugins, as it were?
You know, you're asking the wrong guy. You don't want me to answer that. You don't want me to answer that. You don't want me to answer that.
I mean, obviously,
when a drum sample gets popular as a sound and 80% of the songs on the radio are using the same drum sample, we're in a funny place.
Yeah.
Because we used to be able to tell drummers by how they played and that, you know, just drummers, just that thing of that. And you know, things do change and they do move on, you know, but like you, I'm old.
But you would use...
But even back in the 80s, before, I remember the great Bill Bottrell, who we both worked with a lot, saying, do you want to reckon you how you could date a record by the reverb on the snare drum?
Oh, no, absolutely. It was the SR-2000, is that what it was? SRV-2000, the Roland? You could tell what month the thing was mixed. You really could. You really, really could, man. I still can sort of go, yeah, that's that thing that happened right around then.
And then you think, when the SSL came out, the drum sound was determined, you know, someone like the Big Desk, the SSL, which had its own compression and gates on it, along comes Hugh Padgham and Phil Collins, and they create that sound because of that piece of technology.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the gated reverb, which sounds preposterous now.
Yes, it does.
I'd say Peter Gabriel first did that, didn't he? Peter Gabriel did.
He did. It was when they accidentally, it was when he heard Phil Collins warming up through the talkback mic at Townhouse 2. And it was compressed and gated so badly, they said, let's do that. We're going to lose so much of our audience if we carry on like this.
But when you did those early Madonna albums, you know, were you using drum machines on those? Real drummers?
That's an interesting question. What we had then is there was a sequencer. There was the Roland made it, or sorry, Yamaha had a thing called the QX1, and Roland had a MS-700. I don't remember the names.
So sexy, but these names, did, you know, so sexy, aren't they?
Yeah, do you remember the little thing that you could plug into your Roland digital delay and it would give you a one-shot sample?
Oh.
Okay, this was 1984.
Wow, like a sort of AMS thing, yeah.
Yeah, and you just loaded the sample into it by playing it in, and that was it, and you could tune it. Right. And it, no dynamics, no nothing. Well, we use those for the kick and the snare on True Blue. On the True Blue album, it was real hi-hat and the rest was that thing. And the way we would get it to sync is by making a mark on the tape head and then delaying it in till it was on the mark. You know, so you'd use a delay, you'd use the sync head. So it was ahead of the record head. And then you would use a delay till it was in time.
Wow.
So it was easy. No.
But actually, we're getting ahead now. If we're going to start talking about old albums, let's go back. I want to go back. Because I was going to say to Gary, what's so funny, Pat, seeing as we know each other so well, is actually how little about the other stuff we ever talked about. Anything that wasn't... We're like characters in a Pinter play. It's like you don't exist till you walk through the door. There's nothing before that. Because one of my favourite things in the world is to listen to you play the piano. You're an amazing. So, were you like a child prodigy? Were you? Or...
Oh, what a funny word!
I know. Sorry. All right. Yeah. Good.
Were you good?
Well,
yeah.
I don't know. I played very, very, very young.
Yeah.
I was at the piano in diapers, literally, because my sister was a player and dad was a player, and there were family gatherings at the house. So, by the time I was five, they were trying to give me lessons, and I couldn't read. I didn't really know the alphabet, or I was like four. So that was, you know, didn't happen yet. But in first grade, I played as the accompanist for the school V show right through the high school age in first grade.
What's the V show? The variety show in a school.
And how old's first grade? What is that like?
Five.
What?
You know, so really, really the thing where people would just look and go, what the hell is that? And so very, very young, started very young, and then started taking lessons of all kinds. And my dad was a jazz musician and did clubs, jazz musician. He did nightclubs, you know, he did nightclub music. And
This is in Michigan.
This is now in Chicago. So when I was six, we moved to Chicago. So at about 9, I started doing the first set for his Friday night gigs in a trio playing a little Parpizza because his keyboard player didn't get out of work. He worked at Penny's in the shoe department or something, and he didn't get out of work. So, you know, I started playing that first set. And then because I had my little Farfisa and could play the beginning of Light My Fire and the beginning of Inagata De Vida, by the time I was 11, I was in about 5 bands because I could play those intros. Wow. You know? So it was just that kind of crazy stuff. You
so
know?
You're playing prog at 9.
Well, you know, you start smoking pot. And, you know.
I guess this is an early sort of West Coast kind of stuff that you were into, the Doors and bands like that. Was that what was in your musical world?
The differentiation between where something was from or what it was unimportant. You know, like
of course, at that age, you wouldn't. Yeah, it's...
no. I mean, I was just, my dad was having me listen to all of the jazz greats. My sister was a classical musician, but she was 9 years older than me, so she was a teenager when the Beatles came out. So I was getting hammered with all the pop stuff, and she took me to see Hendrix, and she took, I mean, I was at the Grant Park Sly Stone thing. You know, that what? Crazy thing. I was how there the with my sister.
Sorry, what was that?
I was 9 or 10 years old. I was just a kid. 68. What was that? I was 12.
No, what was that? Elaborate on that show, because I that's well, not come up on my
it's
radar.
It's hard for me to remember, but it had to do with the SDS and the Students for Democratic Society and all this stuff in Chicago. And they did a concert at Grant Park and it turned a little violent and the police came in and tear gassed. And I mean, I don't really remember much of it about it.
What the move is about. Is
yeah,
that, right.
That's it. I was there with my sister.
Wow.
And I was a little boy. We got out of there, but I was there.
And did your dad have ambitions for you to follow him? Was he a professional musician, your dad?
He was a really, really good player and a really good singer, but he never really was professional because he raised the family, you know? It's the we always come home guy. He played sax and loved it, but he was a family man with 3 kids. So he played on weekends, you know, like that.
But he had ambitions for you to get into music? Or...
I remember at one point, it was fairly clear what I was going to do because my school was a nightmare and it was just about playing. And he said, you've chosen something really, really hard. And he said, if you can figure it out, find something to fall back on. Because he said, you really picked a rough one, you know, to just do this thing. But I think it was fairly obvious fairly early that, you know, I was going to at least be able to make a living doing it. You know,
yeah, so was that it? It was just set, right, with you? There was just no question.
No, I mean, I was thrown out of high school at the beginning of my junior year, so I was 16. And a week later, a kid called me and said, my mom works with this band. They're a show band. The keyboard player just quit. The mother drove me to a little town in southern Michigan, and I started playing in the show band, you know, a week out of school, and did that for a couple of years.
What would the set list be like for them?
His name was Galen, and I think he's still around. He was a pianist, kind of a Liberace kind of act, and he was a very fine pianist. And I was behind him with a Mini Moog and a Fender Rhodes, and then I got a Mellotron, and I was just building this stuff up and just doing orchestrations, but they were really just chord charts. So it was a great lesson for like, oh, I need to make up parts for this stuff. So we would do 2 shows a night, which were, you know, what he would do. And then we do dance sets, and the dance sets would be dated by, you know, probably did Ain't No Sunshine 8 times a night, you know.
Yeah.
It was that.
Funny enough,
I've never heard
you play that. I wonder why that could be.
but Pat,
and you never will.
Regular listeners to our show know our love of prog, and if that's how you started as well. And funnily enough, you know, this is American kid living in Chicago, and you're into Gentle Giant and Jethro Tull and the Brit prog stuff.
This is what I love, by the way. This is something I want to start off with, was the fact that I'm sitting here with 2 absolute titans of 80s mainstream pop music. You both wrote songs that absolutely shaped and defined what that era sounded like and was. And you're the biggest pair of prog heads I've ever met.
Yeah.
So, along with Trevor Horn.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I still... if I'm in a clean, I'll still put on Thick as a Brick, you know, because it just makes me happy, or Passion Play, or, you know, and the Gentle Giant stuff, I still occasionally show people and then explain how many teenagers went running from my house. Because it's like, I can't do that. I just can't do this. I say, you've got to hear this, you know, and put on In a Glass House or something, you know, and say, just check this out. Yeah. And I'm fascinated and think that music does not get any better than this. And they're horrified in the biggest way imaginable. So I scared a lot of teenagers.
And it's really going to win the hearts of girls, isn't it, when you bring them back?
Oh, God. I was a very lonely teenager until I realized that all you had to do was mention the Rolling Stones and at least you had a chance, you know?
Yeah. And there's that,
No.
There is that actual connection with Derek Shulman, who we have to get on the show, the lead singer of Gentle Giant. And Ian Anderson, because we had Ian on the show, and he was saying, you know,
Derek, I saw that. I listened to some of
Derek
it.
Derek signed him, didn't sign them when later on in his career. Am I remembering that?
That's
right.
That's right. Yeah, Derek Shulman was the A&R guy who signed Jethro Tull, wasn't it? Was it Jethro? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Or advised Ian. No, he gave Ian some advice. It was to do with Passion Play. You know what?
By Farms.
This is awful. I need to listen to my own show.
Salmon.
So what about writing, Pat? When did you you writing stuff by then?
Yeah, I didn't. I resisted sight reading and I resisted other people's music, and I don't know why I did, but I did. So I started putting little dots on a page when I was very, very little. That's really what I wanted to do, is write music.
That's exactly how I started, Pat, in that I had no interest in writing other people's songs. I learned four chords for another song, and I thought, well, I like these chords, but I hate the tune that they've given me. You know, I'll make my own up. And I think that was, were you performing those songs, sticking them in your band?
Sometimes in some of the bands I was in, we would do some of that stuff. And, you know, when I was, I don't know how old I was, there was a band I was in called, I think it was called Heaven, I think. And it was, everyone was always older than me until a point, and now, of course, I'm older than everybody.
Yeah, we all but have that. It's so funny. Yeah, you have that thing when
I was
a
young kid.
No. It's to do with policemen, isn't it? As soon as you're older than most of the police.
So anyway, we had this band and we played in this house and we played some gigs and teen clubs and what all. And then the Mellotron was coming out and this guy convinced his mother to take a second on the car so we could buy a Mellotron, which I think was like $5,000.
Wow.
So we drove to Rockford, Illinois. And that if we had this Mellotron, we were going to be huge. So we drove to Rockford and went to Nielsen Music and bought the Mellotron from Rick Nielsen, who was in a band called Cracker.
What was his band? What was his band?
The band was called Cracker, I think. Before Cheap Trick, his dad owned the music store and he worked there. So we bought a Mellotron in, I don't know, must have been around 1971 or 72.
Is this why he had so many guitars to begin with, you think?
Probably. You know, yeah.
And the Mellotron is like a sampling machine. It's taped sounds, you know, famously from Strawberry Fields. Yeah. Strawberry Fields, yeah.
Stairway to Heaven, White Shade of Pale, I think, as well.
Moody Blues, Mike Pinder. Originally, it was the Pindertron.
Really?
Yes, it was. It was his thing.
Wow.
I mean, somebody will say, no, there was someone else that did it first. That's what
And we had Colin Blunstone on last week, and the Zombies, obviously, you know.
Yeah. Mellotrons were great. They were fun. It was cool. You felt like God, even though, you know, of course, the irony was I had this $5,000 keyboard and a $29 amp, you know, because we didn't have any money. So it didn't sound great, but it was a Mellotron. And it didn't work. We didn't become a huge band.
Was there a moment, Pat, where you thought, this isn't going to work for me? Or was it a continual rise to stardom and success?
No, I had a band called Trillion, and we were a prog band.
You don't say, Trillion.
You think? You think that they're a prog band?
Well, we were a really serious prog band, and none of that stuff ever got recorded. Because we signed to Sony and they wanted something poppier. So we had these other songs and we scaled everything back. And you know, one of these days I still want the fans of Trillion to hear the stuff we did before we did that. Cause we were doing, I was writing 40 minute pieces, you know, we were in clubs and people were going like, what the fuck is going on? You know?
That's good. So you got a deal. So that's, you know, that wouldn't have been Sony back then. That would have been CBS, right?
It was CBS. That's right. It was CBS. It was Lenny Pizzi and Sandoval or whatever.
And how did you get, that means someone's gone to New York or LA, right?
That means that we did showcases and they came to Chicago and we signed with them. And then we went with Gary Lyons to Caribou Ranch and did the first record.
Oh, right. Wow.
Yeah. And then we changed singers and did a second record. And then I left the band and then starved and then did Jingles in Chicago and then got blown across Michigan Avenue in a snowstorm and called my friend Hawk in LA, who said, I'm on the phone with Randy Jackson about some tour thing. I'll call you back. He calls me back and he says, I can't do it. You want to do a tour with the Jacksons? So that's how I got out of Chicago. I just ramped this forward. So now we're in LA.
So the Jacksons. Oh, no,
but you ended up living in Hawk's house, didn't you?
Well, I was next door to him. We were next door.
Because the first time I met you was at your studio, in your, which apparently was where Ain't Nobody was.
Hawk is right around the corner.
Because Hawk produced Ain't Nobody by Chaka Khan.
Yeah, and wrote it.
Yeah.
And so you played with the Jacksons initially, is that what you...
Yeah, my first thing was I auditioned kind of cold, actually, for the Victory Tour. And I went in and I didn't know any songs. I just flew out and went into a rehearsal hall in North Hollywood. And there was a DX7 on stage and a set of drums. And it was Jonathan Moffat. And I think Jackie and Tito and Marlon were there first. And they said, do you know any songs? I said, no, I don't. They said, what do you want to do? I said, well, just jam. So Jonathan and I just jammed, right? And then I'm hanging around watching other people load their rigs in and hearing them do perfect renditions of Thriller. And I thought, I'm going home. So I went back to Chicago.
Pat, what year is this? Just the
84. This is the Victory Tour 84. So maybe the end of 83, I don't really know, but right around then. So I went back to Chicago. Everybody said, how'd it go? I said, you know, this is never going to happen. A couple of weeks, I get a call, come back. So I come back and it's the same exact setup. Except now David Williams is there with Jonathan.
So
David's there in this little room, and they said, you know any songs? I said, I didn't go home and learn them. I didn't figure I had the gig, you know? So we just jammed again, and then I heard more people come in with their roadie setting up gear, just nailing this stuff, every sound, every part. And I thought, no, this is a joke. And about a week later, they said, can you start right away? They called and came out. So I ended up, you know, musical directing this thing basically and programming all the synths and all that stuff, and the band was amazing. And at
this
one
was the
point
big tour, right? That's the one from the live album is from, isn't
it? The Victory. Yeah. I don't think they made a live album from it, but the I haven't heard.
Was Michael in it?
Yeah, it was Thriller basically.
Yeah,
right.
That's what it was. It was the Victory Tour. So it was the one with Don King involved and all this controversy the stories about that. We could fill hours with it. But as the thing went on, I asked Nelson, who was the road manager, how I got this gig, because it did not make any sense to me. It never really did at that point. And he said, Michael asked David. And David said that white kid from Chicago is the only one that can keep time.
We need to point out who David Williams is. We need to point out who David Williams is. I mean, everyone, you know, like the greatest sort of R&B rhythm guitarist ever. Or Billie Jean, right? That's David Williams.
Yep, that's David Williams.
I adored that guy. He once said to me, you and me, we're the top of the workers in this town making a living out of three notes.
And I'm sure he
David played three.
what does Niall think?
What I should have said, the other greatest. You know.
Yeah.
Niall's the cool guy. David's the single note guy.
Yeah. David couldn't play chords. Yeah. He had like sausages on his hand. And he was just the most remarkable timekeeper I've ever heard. Yeah.
And that was a gift because, in fact, don't want to get ahead, because, of course, it was through you that Brian Ferry met him, and he was an absolute staple of Brian's stuff. I did a tour with him. He ended up in Roxy Music. And for all the Roxy Mark II stuff, it was just amazing. For all the Avalon Manifesto stuff, he was absolutely perfect. But it used to be an absolute joy standing next to him on stage with him trying to figure out what the hell was going on anything from the first three albums. It's something like remake, remodel. It's just like, what the, what?
Is he still around, Guy?
No, sadly not.
No, he passed away. No. But he was amazing. And like for the Jackson stuff, sound checks or rehearsals or anything, when Michael would come, the first thing he'd say is, make me dance, David. And that was how we started everything. It was always that same thing.
Really?
So David would just start, and it was like,
what was it like? What was it like watching Michael every night on stage doing his thing? I mean,
well, you know, occasionally, you know, I'll be in a grocery store and Billie Jean will come on, and I'll say to my wife, I'll say, I'm probably the only guy in the grocery store that played this bass line and this part and watched him dance for a year and a half.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, it was absolutely staggering to be able to do that thing and kind of check in with myself. Like, I'm actually doing this right now. You know? It was my first gig, really. You know what I mean?
You're creating the musical magic that is feeding the rhythm in this guy's body and getting him to do that thing. You know, I mean,
yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. No, fun. I mean, lucky.
Yeah. And so after that tour, now this is where I'm not saying that isn't interesting. That's unbelievable.
We digress.
So I'm very interested in the sequence of events here, because we've never talked about this with you, Pat, mm-hmm. which is that. So right. were you hired to do, did you tour with Madonna first?
Yes. What happened is after the Jackson tour, I'd set up a house in L.A., and really wanted to get into making records and not really touring. And of course there were people there that knew that I had done 3 years of jingles. So I was getting calls to do that, which I never did, because I didn't want to do that. Freddie DeMann, who was Michael's manager before the tour, once the tour started, he had changed over to somebody else, but he was Madonna's manager. And he'd called my managers, who I had through Hawk. They were Hawk's managers. I mean, everything was just kind of what was around. And Madonna wanted whoever did the Victory Tour to do her first tour, which was the Virgin Tour. And my immediate response was, the girl in her underwear? No. and they said, would you talk to her? So I did. And she said, never done this. No pushback. Your show, you pick the players, you know, you're in charge.
Wow.
So I kind of couldn't resist that. And so that's...
Because it's not like Madonna's used, you know, known as being a controlling or...
She was good for a word, man. She was good for a word. And so that was the first tour. And then I did the next tour as well, which was called Who's That Girl? But it was really True Blue.
Before we get to True Blue, though, Pat, so you're... You know, those songs that you were playing with Madonna, you know, these are from albums that are produced by Nile Rodgers and Jelly Bean. And, right. You know, right. These were other people's songs. So
yeah.
were you still writing at this point thinking, I know what this girl needs?
No, I was waiting to go home. You know, I mean, I this was a gig. This was just a gig. I wasn't thinking about it as anything. I really wasn't. What happened is I was trying to get a movie score. I wanted to score movies, and my managers represented a guy who was doing his first film, and I went in and I started writing a template for his movie to try to get the score. And the music was Live to Tell. That was what it was. That's what I wrote for it. And I asked Madonna if she would write the lyrics for the song, because it would really give me a boost in terms of getting the film. And she agreed to do it. And this is really the truth. She's on her way to the house, and my manager called and said they hired somebody else. So she gets to the house and I say, sorry, you drove all the way. It's not going to happen. And she said, well, let me hear it anyway, because Sean just did a movie. So she sat down and wrote the lyrics and did the demo for Live to Tell and left with it. And then this all sounds so ridiculous. I went off to Michael Jackson's house because Quincy wanted me to help him put his songs together. So I'm now at Michael's with Quincy trying to put Michael's ideas together. And the person comes in and says, Sean Penn's on the phone. So I take the phone call and he said, can you come here right now? I said, well, not right now.
With Quincy.
I'm a little busy. Yeah. Quincy, can I leave? I have an actor who wants me to come to his house. So I finished and I went to the director's house at Close Range was the movie. in Hollywood and got there and they said, we love the song and we want to use it in the movie. And Madonna says, who's going to sing it? It's too low for me. And everybody went, you're going to sing it. It's beautiful. And she sort of went, okay. And ironically, of course, the lead vocal is the demo. She never sang it again.
Wow.
It was the first, all the records were like that. Everything was like that.
She only ever did a demo. Yeah.
Even Like a Prayer, all of them, those were first takes, only take vocals.
Wow.
I swear to God.
So did you have the melody? Did you sing her the melody while you're playing the piano?
No. We'll get there, how she is as a writer. And then the director says, Madonna says, you can score my movie too. And I said, I can. So lost a movie, wrote the song, got a movie, first single from True Blue. So then there was a live recording from Japan and we were mixing it with a guy named Michael Verdick, who I met. He was the only engineer I knew who did True Blue. He was the only engineer I knew, and I knew him because Hawk was doing a session for Ted Nugent and Verdick was producing the record, and Hawk got bit by a bee and called and said, can you go do this session for me? So I did, and I met Michael. And then when we needed to mix this live recording of the Japan stuff, I called Michael. So now we're in with Madonna in this little tiny room in Burbank, and Madonna looks to me, this is after we'd written Live to Tell, and says, is this where we're going to make the record? And that's how she asked me to make this record. And then the songs were written like so quickly. And that's kind of how the beginning of that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is what I find stunning, Pat, is just that thing. Right? Okay, because Live to Tell, that was your first thing, which is an extraordinary song, I must say, an absolute. That riff is one of my favorite. I could listen to that on a loop forever.
Lucky Lucky Moon. I'll send you one. I'll make a loop for
you. Would you?
Sure.
But here's the thing. Madonna, you know, she's this huge artist. Like I said, her last album was with Nile Rodgers, who was the king of the world at that point.
That's right.
And then, you know, you, this guy in her band, has written a song. No, you write and produce the whole next album. It's like, what?
Yeah.
The record
company was horrified. And, of course, she wouldn't let them come down. And it was Warner Brothers, so it was basically Michael Austin and Lenny Warnker were the point men on it. And she wouldn't let him hear anything until it was damn near done. And I remember sitting in Michael's little studio, and these two guys were sitting next to each other. And pretty soon they're slapping each other on the back laughing. About four songs in, it's like, this could work, you know? Because all the songs were good on that record. It was a good record.
But it's a great record. It's interesting now listening to it now, because there's things like Open Your Heart and stuff where it's all, I mean, it's kind of, it's so similar. There was such a coalition of stuff. It's like, it's almost like a Scritti Politti record. It was like, you know, everything was coming together. So I was wondering, what was your toolkit for that? Because, you know, you weren't a pop writer, were you? That wasn't your dream. So
good question.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, another story is that Live to Tell, I mean, not Live to Tell, La Isla Bonita was a call from Quincy to request a song for Michael that was like a Sade kind of thing. So I just wrote La Isla Bonita and sent it to him and said, we don't like it. And then Madonna came over and I said, I just sent this. They don't like it. So we finished it for her, you know? I mean, the stuff was just...
And it seems to suit her personality because it had that Latin feel. And at the time, you know, that just seemed to work for Madonna.
It really did, you know?
But this was her growing up album as well, wasn't it? This was her...
True Blue isn't true.
I guess it was musically, she was getting away from sort of just doing, you know, dance music and getting into doing things that were, you know, more mature, if you like.
And then I guess after you've done, I mean, once True Blue happens, and I guess the phone's just ringing off the hook, right, for you?
I don't remember, but it probably was.
Is Brian Ferry next, or what was
Brian Ferry was right after True Blue. Yeah, we did a tour. We did Who's That Girl, which was, I think Who's That Girl was before Brian, pretty sure. And then
I don't know that it was, actually.
It might have been after.
It might have been after.
I mean, I think Brian was right after True Blue.
Yeah. He'll have to go back through his bank statements to find out the facts. But I know we're going to get onto that, but I want to pick you up on something you just mentioned a few minutes ago, which is how the process of writing with Madonna worked.
Yeah.
Is that something you can reveal?
Sure, absolutely. I have, because we've moved recently, I have boxes of music. And it's interesting to look at the boxes of music, because it's every record I ever did is in a box somewhere. And so when you find those things, like A Prayer More Than True Blue, you find the morning when I went in and some sort of title that represents the song, often not the song title, because I was just saying Latin thing for Madonna, you know. And I'd write the chords, I'd write whatever melodic stuff there was. I had an MPC 60 for Like a Prayer, and I'd put the verses and the chorus in, and she'd show up. And I'd say, here's what I got today, and she'd listen to it, and she'd make a suggestion or two, and we would move it around. And then I would let it roll, and she'd sit on the floor and write the lyrics. And while she was writing the lyrics, we'd print it, and she'd do the vocal, and next day, next song. Never more than one day.
What about the top line, though? Was that coming from her?
She sometimes it did. Sometimes it was always suggested in the thing. Sometimes she'd ask me. Sometimes, but it was just now.
Wow.
It was like, I'm here at 11 and I'm leaving at 3. You know, because I don't want to be in traffic.
And genius was spilling out, wasn't it? I mean, you know, incredible pop.
When you listen to it, I can't to this day believe that those are the vocals. Are what they are, but I know they are because I have the demos. So she went in and she would warm up a little bit and just do the vocal and maybe do it again, maybe not. So the lead vocal on Cherish, on Like a Prayer, those are all. Wow. And the other part of it, Gary, and this is where this occurred to me recently. We'd work this out and there would be little hints of what it was, but she didn't sing it before this. This was the first time she sang it.
Can I just point out to listeners that if you're amazing, recording a vocal now, virtually every singer you hear on the radio has his voice put into a box, into the computer, is auto-tuned, is stretched, is cut up. You've done about 6 different options, which are, you're editing between.
More. Yeah.
Editing syllables here and plosives. Yeah. Yeah. This is a woman who goes, this is pure talent, isn't it? Wow.
Well, I can say, really the one I always remember, Pat, is when we recorded Oh Father, which was just done at once. But I think we did one run through, and I don't think we were recording. And Madonna she stood in the control room and she sang it, and she'd never sung it before. And she sang it. And at the end of it, she then gave the whole band notes, which were all absolutely correct. You know, like really not like Make It More Purple. There was like really understandable. It was like, Guy, just hold Duck Eggs. I like that one fill at the end. And then Sugarfoot, lay off that. Da, da. And she'd sung the song for the first time, nailed it, and clocked everything everyone was doing.
It's 6 people playing and her singing all completely live. And this is at one point she said, why are we doing this? I said, you'll see it. You know, it's going to be, why don't we just do this in pieces? But, you know. Oh, Father, we always said the button was pushed three times.
With someone like Madonna, I mean, she's you know, she's famously emotional, and it can go from dark to light to dark again pretty quickly. You as a producer have to deal with that with her as well. And what is your key to working with any artist, capturing their moods and deflecting?
You know, I mean, I've always felt that I was pretty moody myself, and so I think maybe I understand it. You know, I mean, I can have to leave the room and gather myself and come back, you know, because it's
I've seen this.
Yeah, it's all personal. It's all personal to me, you know, like the thing that sometimes is difficult is if I'm writing the music and I'm playing the parts and I'm helping to arrange the music, I have a huge personal investment in it that's an artistic investment. It's different producing someone else's song. I can sort of do that a lot easier without getting involved in it. But if someone suddenly says, I want to take this bar out, it's like, sometimes it doesn't go over so well with me, you know? So
I get that entirely. I find it, I can't imagine taking music anything other than personally.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I really can't. So this brings us to after. So then did you, the Brian Ferry, because this, I mean, this could not be more chalk and cheese. Getting a vocal, we just did a vocal and that was it. We had the song, it was done. Boy, were you going somewhere
next
else.
Yeah.
And we do love Brian, of course, we love Brian.
Of course, we absolutely love him.
Totally,
love him.
Totally different.
And I love that. I love that record. I love that record.
Bette Noir. Bette Noir.
So, and you turned up with five songs, with five finished songs, didn't you? For five finished tracks.
I don't remember. Yeah.
Apparently, yeah, which was, yeah. But because were you called for that, or had you expressed an interest? Because you were a fan of early Roxy, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, and I think I was called, you know, for it, and I was pleased about it, and I was a Roxy fan, you know.
But I suppose once you have some hits in a particular style, then when the phone rings, people are saying, "Can you just carry on doing that style for me? We want that."
Yeah,
and you're suddenly in a kind of an area of music that maybe isn't where you want to be. You know.
Well, I also think, you know, and I haven't thought of this until you just said that, but when you think of True Blue, the hits that I did were Live to Tell and La Isla Bonita and Open Your Heart, and they, you know, like those three songs could be definitely three different people.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there wasn't necessarily something that was pegged, except that it was musical. I think there was a musicality about it and a certain degree of pop sensibility just from growing up with the Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
How do you not have that just from listening to that Beatle record in my entire
time? Was Guy Pratt the guy you had to call for bass? Was that, how did you ever, no, did you, or did you just
I'll
bump
tell,
into
I'll
him?
Tell you exactly how I first met Pat was because we'd been working for it, because Rhett Davis had started off producing the album, and Chester Kamen and myself had been brought in as sort of Brian's little sorcerer's apprentices, and we were having great fun smacking around in the studio. Rhett suddenly decides he doesn't want to be in the music business anymore and announces he's retiring to go and play golf. So Chester and I, it's just me and Chester, like, you know, just messing about with Brian's stuff, and we're having the time of our lives. But then I think the record company are like, yeah, this is great and everything, but we kind of need to be making an album here, which is where you come in. And I was flown out to LA, and I had to sort of pretend I happened to just be in town and come down to your house. And like, oh, God, what's you been here? And so come and play on some. In fact, I remember Mark Fenwick, Brian's manager at the time, actually said, have you got someone whose sofa you can sleep on? I was like, no, you'll fly me to LA. You put me in the Mondrian. But what was lovely, you came over and you clearly took to myself and Chester.
Yes, big time, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, I mean, we had a lot of fun times. And, of course, and that's, so, you know, another one. Because, again, the three biggest relationships in my life, work-wise, are still functioning. Brian, yourself, and this other person who's about to come into the picture, which is David Gilmour.
Ah.
This is how you met David, isn't it? And became, and got to write a song on the Pink Floyd.
That's
album.
Right. It was the Brian Ferry record, yeah.
But I do want to tell this story.
Because Gilmour was played on Brian's album. Is that what
I'm about to tell the story?
Ah.
So we're at Air Studios, and we just, Pat, you just got a track up, and I don't know if it was one of yours or one of the things that Chester and I've been messing around with. And you were sort of thinking out loud, and you went, oh, you know what would be great on this? One of those kind of Gilmour triplet delay things. That would be fantastic. And Brian goes, oh, what, David? Shall I get him down? And you went, what? What? And then suddenly Brian's on the phone, goes, David, yeah, hi, Pat, Thursday? It's Thursday, got it? And you were literally just like, what? And that's how it happened.
Yeah, because I guess you were a Floyd head as well, if you're into Jungle Giant.
Oh yeah.
But so David came. I mean, David played all over the album, didn't he? And you know, in that magnificent way, and he can. Yeah. But then he was interested in you, wasn't he? So he invited you over to his place to try and mess about.
Yeah, and we went. We had lunch at the house, and then went down to Astoria.
That's his boat.
This is David's beautiful houseboat studio.
David's
on the Thames.
Boat. Yeah, subtle. And and. As I remember, there was just a couple keyboards, and we started jamming. And there was one of them had a repeat thing on it, and we just got a chord progression going and played it and played it. And David was playing fretless bass, and we talked about this and that,
And
he said there might have been a bottle of wine involved.
I think there was a bottle of wine involved.
Would have been maybe a bottle of very fine wine, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably. Yes, I think I think there was. And I think we watched races on the telly, and the thing then became, well, then what happened is I was back in LA, and David called and said, I'm in town and we're working on the new album. Would you like to come in and listen to the roughs? I said, sure. So I went to the house he was renting, and he's playing things, and the song comes on. And this was not early days, but it wasn't finished yet. It lacked some overdubs and what all, but the song goes by and it finishes, and he says, did you recognize that? And I said, no. And he goes, well, you wrote it. So it was, and this was this jam we did that day that he finished off as yet another movie. And then from there, he came to the house, the same house you worked at, Guy, mm-hmm. We did overdubs on that and some other songs on the record. And,
okay, so let's move along. So,
I just want to grab him for one thing, because I love, love Boz Scaggs, right? And you work with Boz Scaggs. Yeah. I mean, how was that?
I think the song I wrote with David Williams.
Oh, you did.
I don't remember, but I think David and I wrote that song, and that's how that happened. What was it? Was it Cool Runnin'? Is that the name of the song?
I don't know. It was on Other Roads, was it?
Yeah, I think it's called Cool Runnin'. If I remember correctly, I think it was kind of the demo that we did, and then they overdubbed to it.
But did you work with him directly?
No.
Oh, not. Yeah, right. So you're a jobbing writer as well.
Well, I mean, those things happen occasionally. It wasn't really. I always tended to produce the things I wrote, but occasionally a song would get written and somebody would cover it. It happened with when I first moved to LA. There was a Stephanie Mills record that I didn't produce, and there were songs. Actually, Hawk produced it, and there were songs that I wrote.
Guy, should we be doing this chronologically, or do we come off the back of David and go straight to Roger? And
we can't. Well, except we're missing out. Well, we've kind of sort of done Like a Prayer, because that's where I remember it was, because then I came off the Floyd tour and came straight to LA to do the Like a Prayer album, which, incredibly important album. I mean, that really was the Madonna Growing Up album. In fact,
come on. Oh, come on. This is what he's been waiting for.
I happen to have sitting here my cherry red Spectre NS2 bass, I actually played on that song. Pat, in fact, I did lots of stuff.
Pat's got a keyboard.
It happens to be plugged into an octave pedal. Anyway, there.
I should have thought about this.
Because let me get away with the maddest bass performance on a pop record ever.
I couldn't agree more. And I always tell people we were sneaking Weather Report by Madonna while we were doing it, basically.
I still don't remember it happening. It's the one song on the album I don't really remember recording. I don't, I know it was just you,
I
me,
wonder
Madonna
why.
And Bill in the studio.
Yeah. I mean, as I remember the chronology, it was Like a Prayer, Toy Matinee, Amused to Death.
Yes.
So between Like a Prayer and Roger was Toy Matinee.
And Toy Matinee was your band, right? You guys formed a band, which I think is a brilliant album, I have to say. I love that album. I mean, it is proggy, but it's proggy and commercial at the same time. And fantastic musicianship on there.
It's kind of like, the funny thing is, all our American, I'm guessing most of our American listeners will be going, oh, yeah, Toy Matinee, yeah, love that. English people are going, what? It gave birth to the whole Sheryl Crow phenomenon, but all came out of it, and it was an extraordinary thing. But I always say that's like, it's our Velvet Underground record, in that 300 people bought it, but they all started bands.
So what was the Sheryl Crow connection, Guy? What was the
Sheryl Crow connection was that Kevin Gilbert, who was sort of Pat's partner in crime on it, co-writer and singer, very, very brilliant, but then did a weird thing of in starting a band and taking it on tour afterwards. I don't know. I wasn't around for all the stuff that happened afterwards. But then he started going out with Sheryl Crow, didn't he? And then there was this Bill Bottrell, who'd produced the album, started this thing called Tuesday Night Music Club, or Thursday, whatever, at his studio in Pasadena, where people used to go and drink tequila and hang out and mess around. And one of them was Brian McLeod, who was the drummer in Toy Matinee. And from that, just all this material came out, which became Tuesday Night Music Club, the first Sheryl Crow album.
Right.
Brilliant. Wow. Yeah, anyone who hasn't heard Toy Matinee should go to find it and listen to it, because it's Was it your dream then, Pat, to suddenly think, well, now this is really what I want to do. I want to be an artist. I want to be in a proper touring band and make my own music. Or was this just a side project for you?
Well, I always describe it the same way, and I don't know that it's fair to anybody. I had done, I think at that point, 4 Madonna records in a row, kind of, because I did, there was other records in there, but I had done True Blue, and then Like a Prayer, and then I'm Breathless, and Who's That Girl? So there was sort of 4 things. And so Mo Austin from Warner Brothers called me at home and said, you made Warner Brothers about $500 million last year. Is there anything you'd like? Would you like an office? Would you like, what would you like? I said, I want to make a record and whatever I want to do. And he went, great. So it was sort of a cleansing for me.
It was heaven. By this point, Pat has this studio, which is just amazing. Johnny Hume Studio. It's most incredible. Yeah. And we had months, and Pat and I sort of went through musicians and found that. And it was just months and it was just heaven. It was like, I remember Tim Pierce, the legend guitarist who was on it, just as like, he remembers the writing sessions and all he heard was just this laughter coming from the room the whole time. For me, it was heaven. And some of the work I'm absolutely proudest of in my whole career.
Yeah. So. Me too. I feel the same way. It was a real amazing thing. I didn't want to go on the road. You know what I mean? I was enjoying making records. I just wanted.
If I had that studio, I wouldn't want to go on the road.
But this is a problem with session guys who suddenly form a band, because unless it hits it straight away. You know, you've got the phone's ringing with a lot of money at that time, especially in the 80s. Session guys could get paid a fortune. Yeah. And you know, really, the only guys who ever form bands are poor guys who've got nothing else. You know.
Yeah, good point.
I don't know. Michael the Mechanics might sort of slightly break that mold.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean, the thing of, yeah. But it was, you know, but hey, it was a great thing and it was great work. So the next thing is Roger
Waters. Roger Waters.
Yes.
I mean, it's a great album. I think it's one of his best. It's probably his best album.
And of course, and you actually asked me to play on it, didn't you, Pat?
Yes. Did you?
I asked David, and David said, "Yeah, of course, do. It's fine." And I thought, you know what, it really isn't fine. And also, it's like I like my attack. You know, I'd like.
Yeah.
We all know the history of David and Roger, and you know what goes on between them. Did you have a sort of feeling of I better call David if I'm going to do Roger, and I better just because I want to keep that relationship going as well?
I didn't really know David well enough at that point to think of it one way or the other. But while I was in London working with Roger, occasionally I'd go see David or go out and have drinks or go have a dinner or something. And I just remember that it was a little strange to then the next day come to work with Roger. And Roger knew that, last night, and we didn't talk about any of this stuff. Wow. So, it was sometimes a little bit strange, but also, obviously rarefied air.
But this is a dream now, working on a project where you can, build soundscapes and, have cinematic noises coming in.
You're going to the absolute source of
That's right. Yeah.
And you've got Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
Jeff's playing on that album is incredible.
Who brought his A game, and Jeff Beck's A game is the only game in town.
Jeff was such a marvel and a delight. And the first day that Jeff came, we could see through the window of the studio. He pulled up in a jalopy, those cars that he built. The hot rods. And he opens the trunk, and there's a cardboard box, and he rips it open, and he takes out a Fender, Jeff Beck Fender model, and he comes in the studio with it, with a rat pedal in his pocket, and says, "You got an amp?" And we did. We had a twin reverb from the snooker table. And he plugs in, and he kind of tunes up. And the thing just stayed there throughout the whole record. It was really all he used. And at the end of the day, occasionally, Roger would pick it up and strum something on it when Jeff was gone. And it was so out of tune. And he never tuned it, and it didn't matter, because he just tunes while he's... I never saw anything like it. It's really like...
And you've got to listen to his playing on that album if you haven't already. Because that... I mean, I'm not you guys, I'm to the listeners. because it's just sublime. It's exquisite. It's the he's the greatest guitarist in the world, isn't he? I mean,
yeah, that's right. That's what
do you panic as a producer that you've got to capture this? Oh my God, am I getting it right? Am I getting the right reverb around it, compression, or
no? First of all, we had tremendous people recording the record, so. Everything was, you didn't have to think about that at all. Like the beginning of Amused to Death, the intro of Amused to Death, I'm playing a JP8000 or something, or one of the Roland ones, the one with the gray one with all the sliders on. I don't remember what the model is. And we just wanted some sort of an intro. So I just sort of meandered through some chords and Jeff played some stuff and it's the beginning of the record. I mean, we didn't write anything. We didn't do it again. That was it, you know?
Wow.
And so that's stuff that I will never forget doing, because I'm playing chords and Jeff's kind of leading what the next chord should be. Again, rarefied air,
Because you then worked with Jeff afterwards, didn't you? In fact, I did some recording with Jeff with you.
Yes, we did. Did what Jeff refers to as the greatest album we never made. Because we were going to do this and we just kind of never got to it, you know? But we recorded a track with you,
I was terrified.
It was called
so
Nipples.
Scared.
You played great on it. You were great. And it was called Nipples. I think that was the name of it.
God. How did you feel when Madonna didn't call you for the next couple of albums and she went off with, Nellie Hooper going in a different direction?
You used to get called back for the odd single, didn't you? For the big, you did Frozen.
Did come back and did that Ray of Light album.
Yeah,
But was that something that you chose to do, or that did she add? And did you feel kind of bad?
No, I didn't. I mean, honestly, I wasn't. And this sounds a little weird. I wasn't really that attached to it. I was still writing. I don't even know how this makes any sense. My interest in this is the writing. So when I get up in the morning and I write, and I come in here and I write and I write and I write.
That's what you said at the beginning, Pat. You said that at the beginning.
It's just me. Yeah. It's just me. So whoever's on the other end of it, it's only that it needs to be something that I like to do. I think I would love to have what Madonna brought to things, the immediacy of it and the kind of just simplicity of getting it done that easily. But aside from that, I'm just in search of the lost chord. I mean, I'm just doing the same thing I've always done. I'm just looking for something I haven't done yet. And I've always been that way. So I never really felt a personal, I never took any of it personal.
How did you get on with, is it Stephen Bray was co-writing with on that album as well? Was that a relationship that you'd all have together, or was that a separate sessions for Madonna?
Yeah, Stephen's a lovely guy, and we would share, I'd play some stuff on his and he'd do some stuff on my songs and, more on True Blue. Then on Like a Prayer. On Like a Prayer, it was pretty separate,
Express Yourself was him, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
That was done,
When JR came in and played it once, and we all went, that's great. You want to do it again? He went, nope, I got to go. Like one take.
Yeah. We got to talk about Leonard Cohen, shouldn't we, really?
We've got to talk about Leonard Cohen, obviously, yes.
And how that was to work with this.
Right. Yeah, how did that come up, Pat?
Well, I produced a record. I had worked on a couple songs for Adam, his son's band. They were called Low Millions. And then Adam asked me if I would produce a solo record for him. And I agreed to do it and did that record. And it was a very cool little record, very kind of simple, nice sounding, very nice sounding record. And I forced live performances, where he had to play and sing at the same time. Otherwise, we weren't doing it. And he didn't like that very much, but it made a great record, and then from that, his dad heard the record and, I don't know if he asked to meet me or if Adam suggested it or what, I don't really know. But we had a tuna sandwich at a little deli with Adam and Leonard one day just to talk about working. And then Leonard and I think I moved a little gear over to his house, just very simple little something. And he handed me the lyric for the song Show Me the Place, which was from Old Ideas. And I showed it to him, and he put a vocal on it, and it was just very quickly done. And then the next day he said, the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me is he said, do you think anybody ever asked the guy who wrote Amazing Grace if he has anything else? So, you know, then we just started writing songs.
I just want to stop you. So he would give you the lyric that day. He gave you the lyric and you found the sort of rhythm in the words, the scansion. You found a piece of music that you felt went with it. And then did he just start singing over the top of your chords or?
No, I wrote the melody and the chords to the lyrics. And on that one, I got lucky. Come Healing was like that. Going Home was like that. They were very, very, I just let the lyric tell me what to do, and I did it really quickly, and only ever the one version. And then for Popular Problems, it was the same thing. He'd send me the lyric, and I'd write something at home, and I'd put a vocal on it, and I'd send it back to him.
But had he done that before? I mean, didn't he just kind of come up with the whole thing himself before?
He did.
Was this a new process for him?
I think he'd done co-writing with some people. And I think it was a very similar thing. But the anecdotal things that Leonard said were, you know, so beautiful. Like when we started, he said, I grew up with 78 records, and 78 records are someone in the front telling a story, and then there's this stuff in the back. You're going to be the stuff in the back.
Brilliant.
Which I love.
Yeah.
You know?
Because what's amazing, listening, you know, must be working with, I mean, you know, you've worked with so many great people, but with Leonard, I was listening to You Want It Darker, and the thing with... that whole album is every single line is a bullseye. Like there is an ounce of there's not an ounce of fat on it. You know, it's
no, and the work extraordinary. Leonard's work ethic, his method, his what he would do. And I think it's okay to share these things. I don't think he would mind. He had a room with shelves in it with little boxes. And the box would have the song title on it, like office boxes, you know, those things with the little metal corners, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in the box would be a bunch of little notebooks about this big, just little notebooks. And
as big as a protein bar. As big as a protein bar, right?
Yeah. About the size of a protein bar.
For our listeners.
Yeah. And then he'd use this. So he would, I'd get to the house and he'd be sitting in the front yard of the house in this little neighborhood he lived in. In a three-piece suit, which he was always in a suit. And he would write, he'd have a box out, and it would be for, like, you know, one of the songs. And he'd work on it, and then he'd put the thing back. And then every once in a while, he would take out one of these boxes, and he'd take all the new verses, and he'd put them in his computer. And sometimes this went on for a decade.
Wow.
Until he felt he had the verses.
Wow.
So,
extraordinary.
You Want It Darker, that song was called something else. I have pages full of those quatrains, full, 5 pages.
Wow.
And he just picks the ones that makes a song, and he spends years on it.
So he's kind of making a patchwork quilt out of these different words that are coming in. And
yep. And so, you know, there's that thing of Hallelujah taking so long. It's like, they all took that long. I mean, that's not true. There's some things he would just put down and he was kind of done and he'd tweak it a little bit. But those kind of major works of his, he worked on for a long time. And I never saw anything like it. And I learned a lot from it, but to actually practice it is a very difficult. The discipline is passed with way beyond me to be able to say, nope, not yet, not yet, not yet, not yet. Like the song Treaty, the song that ends You Want It Darker, the version that's on there is the first version I did with him with a lyric change in it. I probably did, and this is the truth, I probably did no less than 30 versions of Treaty. The same lyrics, same melody, but different takes on it, a country version, a blues version, a simple version, an orchestrated version, a string quartet version, like just to try to find it. And then one day Leonard said, I don't think it's in music. I think there's this, I got to find this word. And from the day I met him till You Want It Darker, he still worked on finding that one line in Treaty. And once he found it, we were done. And we were right with the first version I'd ever done. because that was kind of the fresh one and the one that, you know, felt the best.
We wish these moments had been filmed and recorded, because it's the making of this product that is sometimes the most fascinating. Yeah. What are you doing right now, Pat? And I'm going to stick in another question as well, which is, who's the person you'd like to work with that you haven't?
What I'm doing right now is just trying to get my studio set up. We've just moved from the West Coast to the East Coast with a long stop in Michigan, where I'm from. And so we're busy setting this up and trying to get everything working. And, you know, this is, looks nice, but it's a little bit of a mess.
That's a big move. Why did you decide to do that?
I think just the change, and also I'm a Midwesterner and I need to fish and I need seasons. And, you know, like once the work in LA wasn't, once Leonard was gone, there was nothing to stay for. And the question of people saying, who are you going to write with after Leonard? I said, I'm pretty sure Leonard's the last house on the block in terms of collaborators. Like, what do you, you know, who now, you know, when your email dings and it's a Leonard Cohen lyric, that's pretty good. So,
Who's better than that?
In the middle of this and in search of the lost chord, you know, I work every day, sometimes just improvisational. Sometimes I'll just make a modular patch and then my Steinway's sitting over here and I'll just play the piano over it. Just, and not looking for music, looking for long lines. That makes any sense. You know, like I feel, I've always felt that things that have a long line, that have a complete line to them, are what is the most beautiful. And so the improvisational stuff helps me experience the long line. If I can sit and do a 20-minute improv to some modular thing that's, you know, self, you know, generating all kinds of weird stuff and respond to it and react to it, it's good work. It's good exercise, you know. They're not
Pat, it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Real joy. Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. I mean,
we're always lovely to talk to you.
Absolute, like, Christmas pudding of stories, wasn't it? I mean,
just, you guys are great, man.
Endless beauties coming out. I mean, I'm really, really going to, I'm going to listen back to this one a few times, I think. Well, Guy, I felt that was a sort of mostly about you.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Not at all. It was really lovely because you had so much, you were there on the spot. And these incredible moments.
It's in the room where it happened. It was, but having said that, that's why it's so good, because you had really great sort of questions. Because of course, I just wanted to, like, you know, just like a reminiscing lunch
with an old mate. But oh my word, what a bunch of stories we had there. Really, from so many great artists. You know, when you say, you know, I got Sean Penn over here, I got Quincy over here, I got Madonna here. Well, I mean, anyone who doesn't know any of that work, go and listen to it now, especially the Toy Matinee, which I know Guy is very proud of. And
yes, indeed. But no, but the Leonard, you know, to hear that Leonard Cohen, because those albums are beautiful. That's Old Ideas and You Want It Darker.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic to hear those stories.
Absolutely. We'll be back next week with someone else, someone special, someone huge in rock. Until then, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from all of us.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.